This is not quite the start I thought we were going to have, but notice how your body is really interested in what's going around here. Notice you're leaning forward. Thank you. Notice what's happening in your mouth. Yes. Notice whether you find it pleasant or unpleasant.
Definitely pleasant.
Yes. So, welcome to this first evening of Bellingham Insight's third annual practice period. I'm Jean. I'm a community Dharma leader and a member of the Bellingham Insight Teaching Corps. So tonight, I'm going to give an overview of what a practice period is, and I'm going to talk about the theme of our practice period. And then we'll have a chance to break into small groups and meet each other and talk a little bit about the substance of this talk. So this is going to be the format for the next 6 weeks, Dharma talk, getting together. I don't know if cookies will be part of the format or not. So what is a practice period? A practice period is a time to study and practice together with a particular focus. So it's an opportunity to deepen and clarify our practice both on and off the cushion. So there is an historic basis to this. In the time of the Buddha and afterwards, the monks practiced and traveled alone. And during the rainy season, they couldn't do their walking because the water covered the fields and walking through the water would damage the crops, thereby affecting all the people. So they gathered together and they practiced together for 3 months. And so it's kind of a metaphor because we all have our own lives and we all do our various practices, but really one of the focuses of this time is to really appreciate our community and to appreciate our practice together. And so that's one of the reasons that every evening we want to break into small groups and actually talk to each other, a chance to talk about the Dharma. So last year, our focus was on the five hindrances, and just as a reminder, the five hindrances are mental factors that hinder our progress in meditation and in our lives. And those are desire, aversion, restlessness, and worry, sloth and torpor, and doubt. It sounds kind of grim, but really it was a very interesting and fairly cheerful practice period. This year, our focus is on the first foundation of mindfulness, and so I want to explain a little bit about what that is. Our meditation is often called vipassana or insight practice. And vipassana is a Pali word meaning insight or clear seeing. And the methods or the ways to achieve this clear seeing come directly from the Satipatthana Sutta. Now, a sutta is a Pali word for text or sermon or teaching. And Satipatthana is often translated as foundations of mindfulness. So this is a sutta, a teaching by the Buddha about the foundations of practice. So I'm going to read the first part of this sutta, which is the basis of what we're going to be doing together. The Buddha said, "This is the only way, monks, for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the destruction of suffering and grief, for reaching the right path, for the attainment of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness." What are the four? Herein, in this teaching, a monk lives contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. He lives contemplating feelings in feelings, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. He lives contemplating consciousness in consciousness, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. He lives contemplating mental objects in mental objects, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. So that's the end of the intro. So we've all probably had some experience with the first foundation, body practices, in that many of us use the breath as an object of awareness, and one of the practices in the first foundation is mindfulness of the breath, which will be the subject of next week's Dharma talk and conversation. Ajahn Santi, who is an American-born monk who is connected to a monastery in Woodinville, outside of Woodinville, has come up several times and given talks on Vedana, feeling, your initial sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So that may be something that some of us have at least had some exposure to. Anyone who's practiced with Andrea Fella or Heather Martin or Steve Armstrong or Ute Janiya has practiced the third foundation, which is contemplation of mind in mind. And the hindrances, our subject of last year's practice period, is the first object in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which are mind objects, mental objects. And I only say that because every practice that we've probably done or will ever consider are in the foundations, and we have had some experience with some of them, so it's not totally foreign. So for the next 6 weeks, we're going to be practicing with and studying the first foundation of mindfulness and the specific practices that the Buddha describes. So the specific practices are mindfulness of breathing, the four postures, full awareness of activities, the body parts, the elements, and the channel ground contemplations, with which a Buddhist scholar, Inalio, calls the corpse and decay contemplations. So channel ground might not be a phrase we know, but corpse and decay we can probably get a picture of. Okay, so the Satipatthana Sutta identifies the subject that we're going to take up, which is the body practices in the first foundation. But the Buddha also gives us attitude guidelines. And our attitude, the way we approach things, is very important. He says our practice should be ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. And so this is the way we'll try to practice. So what would that mean? Ardency might also be thought of as diligence or the kind of energy that we bring to the practice. The Pali word is atapi. And the technical or the sort of specific definition of it is a burner working really hard. So there's a lot of energy in that word, ardency. Clearly comprehending might be thought of as contemplating closely and repeatedly, seeing closely and repeatedly, observing closely and repeatedly. The phrase overcoming covetousness and grief is sometimes translated overcoming longing and sadness or longing and dejection. And so that's one way of looking at it. I think my way of practicing is more in a positive way, which is I try to maintain an attitude of friendly acceptance for whatever comes my way. The Pali word for that might be metta, friendliness. And that was actually the subject of Jill Shepherd's weekend a couple weekends ago. Okay. So we have our subject identified, the first foundation of mindfulness, the body practices, and we have our attitudes at least suggested. So I want to talk a little bit about how a practice period might work for us. So first of all, we want to recognize that there's a wide variety of experience in this room. I mean, for some people, they may be very new to meditation, and they may be very new to Buddhist views. You may know nothing about the Four Foundations, and you may not have thought about the ways that the body is a door to wisdom. On the other hand, you may have been practicing for a long time, and these topics may sound familiar, and you may have even done some of them. So how could a practice period be helpful for wherever we are? So, because our hope is that this is helpful and even fun. So, one way that I found interesting to think about is the three kinds of wisdom. So the first kind of wisdom you might think of as learning. And other ways of thinking about it are borrowed wisdom or conceptual wisdom. So almost all of us start here. We hear a Dharma talk or we read a book on a Dharma subject, and the book presents words we haven't heard, some in Pali, or the words we know may be defined a bit differently than we usually define them. The book or the talk may organize the world in a different way than we've been thinking about, and so we want to know more. So we listen to more Dharma talks or we do more reading. We're borrowing other people's framework or description, but it's where we all start. I mean, there's a little song. We start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to start. I can't sing, so I'll spare you that. And learning can be very seductive. There's so much to learn, and there's so much to read, and there's so many Dharma talks. There's so much to borrow. And at some point, we need to see for ourselves. We begin to include reflection in our practice. So this is the second kind of wisdom, a reflective wisdom, a practice wisdom, a living wisdom, our living wisdom. The Buddha said in a sutta called the Kalama Sutta, Kalama was a city that he was giving this talk in, and he's the one that really suggests we find out for ourselves. The paragraph in the sutta says, "Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon bias towards a notion pondered over, nor upon another seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, the monk is our teacher. When you yourselves know these things are bad, blamable, censured by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to harm and ill, abandon them. When you yourselves know these things are good, blameless, praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them." So we become curious about what the borrowed wisdom, what others have described to us, have to do with us. Is it applicable in our life? Does applying that in our life make us any happier? So I'm going to give you a personal and, at the end, a slightly embarrassing example of moving from borrowed wisdom to reflected wisdom. So one of the practices in the body, in the first foundation, is a reflection on the four elements. And the four elements are water, air, fire, and earth. And so, and there's, Steve's going to, I think, talk about that in a couple weeks. So, you know, it's a very poetic way of describing the world. It seems a bit old-fashioned. You know, is it of any use today? How could a reflection on the four elements work? So, I reflected on the wind element. And, you know, if you think about it, that's, you know, fairly easy. You're out walking and you feel wind on your face. Air element. You're walking past a building and you feel heat or cold out of the vents. Air element. You hear about a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico. Ooh, lots of air element. And then you move it closer to home. Move it from the external to the internal, and you know, it's pretty clear the breath meditation is the air element. In, out, short, long. You know, Steve gave us a lovely guided meditation earlier this evening. But then, and that was all, that seemed pretty easy, kind of pretty, you know. But then I noticed that a burp, also called a belch, is expelled air. But none of us go around saying, ah, the wind element. We say burp or belch. And burp and belch actually have connotations. I don't know. I'm not sure everyone would agree. I think burp is, you know, babies do it, and it's, you're not mad when you notice it, but you notice it. It's like not quite right. But belch? Now, belching is not as possibly good as burping. But in its essence, it's expelled air. And so, but then it got really interesting. I won't name this person, but a dear member of my family has a frequent experience of air coming out the other end of the body. Now, but do I ever say, well, now I do, of course, but was I saying, ah, the wind element? I was saying, you just farted. And I started to think about that, because that was not an observation of expelled air. That was a judgment. That was impolite. That was unpleasant. That shouldn't be done. And I started to notice how all the words I put on something like wind element was a whole series of judgments, a whole us, me, them, good, bad, right, wrong, polite, impolite. And I can really experience the judging mind in that. And I would never have guessed that, you know, starting with, you know, reading about a hurricane in, you know, the Gulf of Mexico would lead me to this place of really listening to the language we use to describe really basic building blocks of our experience. And so that would be, I think, a homey and homely example of reflecting on one of these elements. So I think a practice period provides us with specific topics for reflection and an encouragement to reflect and discuss those with our friends. So we'll see what happens. The third kind of wisdom is sometimes called realized wisdom. And it's the kind of knowing that comes as the mind quiets and for longer and longer periods of time. It's a deep knowing. It's a visceral understanding. It's not an intellectual understanding. It's often called, at this level, an insight. And certainly there are insights of a psychological nature throughout this whole process. But at this level, it's called realized wisdom. So a practice period can be a good time to increase the amount of time that we're quiet, to increase the amount of time we're on the cushion. So that might be something to think about. So with that as background, like what is a practice period and what is the focus of our practice period for the next 6 weeks, I want to think about the sorts of things we might practice together during this time. So the first thing I would suggest is that we really spend a little time identifying our intention. And Steve actually started our guided meditation by saying, what is your intention? Your intention is probably to meditate, so sort of commit to that. Yogi Berra, who's one of my favorite guys, said, if you don't know where you're going, you're liable to arrive someplace else. So it's really helpful to think about what you want to do with this energy during this time. It might be that you want to do more reading on this subject. You want to borrow more. That's great. You might want to take a practice on and do it more regularly. You might want to just practice, I don't mean just, but you might really want to think about your attitude, the kind of energy, the kind of ardency that you bring to whatever practice you decide to do. It's the object, the noun, isn't really important. It's the energy in which you commit that is good. And it's really helpful to think about this intention on some kind of regular basis. Before you get up in the morning, before you sit, after lunch, you know, going for a walk. I mean, to allow it to sort of surface more than once. It's like, you know, it's not like a kind of a New Year's resolution, like, you know, on January 1st, I'm going to make this vow, and then, you know, in a couple of months, I'll kind of review it. The more often we're aware of our intention, the more likely we'll be able to follow that intention. Secondly, to realize how important our time is off the cushion. I mean, it's, you know, we're a meditation group, and you know, so it's easy to think about this is all about meditation, but Ajahn Jeff, who is an American-born monk, who is an amazing scholar and writer, has said, the most basic step in successfully working with intention is to make sure that we stay off the road to hell. And so what is the road to hell? The road to hell is living our life in ways that do not produce peace and happiness. And so the practices of generosity, whether it's generosity of spirit, generosity of time, generosity of money, to live with generosity is to increase our happiness and to increase our chances of being able to follow our intention. To live with virtue, to follow the precepts in terms of not killing, not speaking falsely or harshly, not abusing intoxicants, using one's sexual energy mindfully, and not stealing. To follow those precepts decreases the amount of guilt and remorse we have, and it leads to a peaceful mind. You know, we sit down on the cushion and we're not like, oh God, I wish I hadn't said that, or all those kinds of sadnesses we have. It just decreases that. And so whatever we do, we are able to do with a little more concentration and a little more peace. So to think about that during this time could be good. Thirdly, it is a really good time to commit to a little bit more meditation, a little bit more time to slow down, to pay attention to the mind. So you might want to start a meditation period. You might want to deepen it. You might want to come to one of the times that Steve suggested. You might want to find a Dharma buddy so that you have a person or a gratitude buddy that you have a chance to connect with, like once a week or once a day or whatever you decide. Whatever. But none of this is meant to be intimidating or demanding. They're invitations. So dip your toe in, step into the pool of Dharma up to your knees, or take the plunge. It's our practice period, and we can do with it what we want. You know, I made those phrases up, and I love them. I'm going to say them again. Dip your toe in, step into the pool of Dharma up to your knees, or take the plunge. Okay. So, perfect. So, having looked at practice period and ways to possibly use it, thinking about ways of being, thinking about the first foundation, we're going to now have a chance to talk with each other and maybe have another cookie, which they're just waiting right over there. So this is the way we're going to do it. We're going to divide into groups of three. It doesn't matter if you know each other or not, because you will soon. And I think what I'll do is have you go into groups of three, and then I'm going to ring the bell, and I really would like you to be quiet just briefly so I can explain what happens next. So go into groups of three.